These products rarely lose value, of course. Overall, they increase it. And we have had some specific timepieces that over the last two decades, for example, increased dramatically their value.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.
Welcome back to Irresistible Circular Business, the series that showcases the business practices that deliver irresistible commercial and circular results. We look at examples from different industries across different R strategies. Sponsoring partner of the series is Indeed Innovation, the global design and innovation firm pioneering the circular economy. In each episode, a member of the Indeed Innovation team joins me as a co-host. The last episode with Philips shed light on the commercial benefits of integrating multiple circular strategies. Today, we turn to a different industry in which the product value does not necessarily decline over time, but can actually increase. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, sign up for the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. With a background in political science and government and international affairs and development, she started her career through a fellowship by the Robert Bosch Foundation. During this time, she worked on climate policy at the German Federal Ministry for Economics and Climate Action and at Siemens. Afterwards, she was a researcher at the German Institute for Development and Sustainability. In 2020, she joined Breitling, where she is now the Chief Sustainability Officer. Welcome, Aurelia.
Thank you very much.
After building his academic foundation in history of art and heritage, he spent nearly a decade preserving the legacy of automotive brands. In his current role, he nurtures the heritage of Breitling and shapes the services for owners of historical timepieces. It's a pleasure to have the global head of heritage at Breitling with us. Welcome, Gianfranco.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you so much.
And the third person has an education in product design and built a career at the intersection of technology and human-centric design. He gained deep international experience at firms like Thomson Consumer Electronics and Hauser. For the past 15 years, he has been at the helm of Indeed Innovation, the global design and innovation firm pioneering the circular economy. He's a global thought leader and circularity speaker and innovator and my co-host for today. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. Hi, everyone else. So happy to be today again on the show.
As you might know, I always start with a personal question, which is related to our subject of today. What is one of the things you own that increases in value over time? And I give the question first to Karel.
Yes. And how could it be different than it is a watch, but it's one of those outstanding watches from Jaeger LeCoultre Atmos, which was a present to my parents to their wedding day, which I inherited. So it's something that grows especially more valuable to my heart every day I look at it because it is very, very dominantly situated in the hall of my home.
Wonderful, Aurelia. Any item on your side?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the most treasured things that I own is the recipe for the birthday cake that my grandmother used to make for me when I was a child. And she wrote this down for me, and it still has the stains from being in the kitchen and on the kitchen counter. So it's not something that had a financial cost attached to it, but it's really my most prized possession and that I keep framed. So this is something that just becomes more and more precious to me every single day.
Wow. Great story. Gianfranco, what is it on your side?
Well, I can provide a fun anecdote. A few months ago, I was in Cape Town for my New Year's holidays. And there, I went to visit a very famous art gallery, which was showcasing a beautiful exhibition from a ceramicist. I desperately wanted to buy a piece, but they were incredibly, incredibly expensive. So I said goodbye, thank you very much. And with a little bit of regret, I went on. And then I went to a furniture shop with the aim to accompany some architect friends that were looking for furniture. And in this furniture shop, I see exactly a piece that looks like one of the ones that I've just seen in the art gallery, but much smaller, like one third of the other sizes. And I asked the girl that was there, the piece was indeed from the same artist, but apparently it had been sitting in the shop for 2 or 3 years. So it was even better, an early piece from the guy. So of course I bought it on the spot, and I bought it for 1/50th of the price that was asked by the art gallery. So it actually had gained value through time, because the furniture shop had bought it as an early work from the artist for peanuts, basically. And in the 3-4 years that the art career developed, it became a major success in the country. So I couldn't be happier on that day. It was my Christmas gift to myself.
Wonderful. That's again also a proof point that value is something slightly subjective, yeah, and requires that you can identify the value. And of course, it's also a personal one, as Aurelia mentioned. Let's zoom in on the watch industry and stick, of course, to the topic of circularity. When we think about circularity in the watch industry, how does it differ from circularity in other industries?
So when we consider circularity in the watch industry, we need to also consider the nature of the materials that we are sourcing. If we think about circularity from a material perspective, first of all, and then I'll get into some other factors related to circularity. So of course, in our products, in addition to featuring stainless steel, we are also featuring a good amount of gold. And in this case, it is really important to be able to understand the ultimate origin of the gold that we source. And as we know, depending on the nature of the circularity system that is being used, it may not ultimately be possible to always attest to the origin of the materials therein. In the case of gold, where gold mining can include, unfortunately, serious consequences for societies and for environment, we knew that at the beginning, it was essential that we were able to attest to the traceability of this gold. And of course, reuse, reprocess, bring this high quality gold back into our system in a segregated manner. So at Breitling, and I would say within the watch industry more broadly, it's really important to be able to balance the aim of circularity at a systemic level with other pursuits such as traceability along the way. So for us, one of the first key aspects is to really consider circularity from a systemic perspective, being able to balance the pursuit of circularity with traceability. And next, I think it's really circularity along the supply chain. So our industry, like so many industries around the world, are globally integrated, and we really need to consider what is the impact across the world, whether it may be at a gold mine in Peru, whether it may be at one of our numerous manufacturers or our own facilities in Switzerland, or at one of our suppliers of lab-grown diamonds in Western India. Then if we consider the approach to circularity along the supply chain, of course, we want to be able to work with our suppliers directly of all materials, whether this may be brass, whether it may be another composite that is used therein, to understand how do we increase the share of material that is circular and do this in a way that is respecting our shared values related to sustainability so that we can ultimately have a net positive at the end. And of course, we consider this as well with regards to all of the processes that we have at Breitling. So take, for example, our commitment to be free of plastic waste in just a few months' time. This is also something that matters, because this needs to be addressed at all steps of the process to make sure that it's really holistic and that we're reflecting our values overall. And then finally, I think it's really circularity as a driver of value creation. We know, of course, the immense demand that there is for products that are labeled recycled, circular, or any other aspect of this related nomenclature. And this is really an opportunity for us to meet market demands, to be able to speak in a meaningful way to our overall stakeholder base, and of course, to tangibly demonstrate our commitment to sustainability. So I really see it from these three perspectives that I just listed: circularity from a systemic perspective, circularity along the supply chain, and circularity as driver of value creation.
Yeah, wonderful and quite holistic. What role does the product lifetime play for you? Because, I mean, in general, when we talk about circularity, it's about preserving value. And to me, it seems to be that you're in a privileged position that this is not a fast consumer good. In what way does it
play a role for your circular measures?
Yeah, I think that this is really one of the key parts where we can attest to the value of the product and the fact that we are taking responsibility for the product for the long term. And that's where we're so delighted to have our colleague Gianfranco with us today to be able to speak about the heritage aspects to this. So Gianfranco, I think here I would hand over to you.
Yeah, I mean, we can say that watches, in our case, most of all, the heritage ones have a very long time frame. We recently were very lucky to be able to purchase a pocket watch, which dates back from 1905, which is still perfectly functioning. So the beautiful aspect, sorry, of my work is that it allows us to really retrace the stories that build up the big story of the brand. And with that, of course, also the products that represent the embodiment of these stories. These products rarely lose value, of course. In overall, they increase it. And we have had some specific timepieces that over the last two decades, for example, increased dramatically their value. If I can provide two or three examples, they embody basically our most iconic references. One of them is, of course, the Navi Timer. We should start from the Navi Timer because it's the main icon of the brand. And for example, if you would buy a full gold piece from the Navi Timer production of the 60s, for example, 20 years ago, you would pay around 1/5 or what you may bait today. In this case, the reason is the rarity of the use of gold for this specific timepiece. The Navi Timer was conceived as a tool watch for pilots, so it was, for obvious reasons, mostly produced in steel. But then some limited batches of the watch were actually produced in gold, and the rarity of the bearing between the model and the material makes, of course, increase the value of the timepiece itself. Another concrete case is the Super Ocean reference 807. This reference in particular is the first dive chronograph ever produced by a watchmaking brand. The watch dates back to 1957. In this case, the dramatic increase of the value, which increased more or less 8 times over the last 20 years, is given by two factors. First of all, the fact that the model represents a milestone in ingenuity and advancement of technical watchmaking. As I said, it pairs a vital complication, the chronograph, with the opportunity to go underwater, which was, of course, a fundamental advancement for divers. So it is not only a significant milestone in terms of industry advancement, but it is also a very rare timepiece because, as you can easily imagine, those pieces were expensive back then, and also they tended to be prone to, for example, corrosion because they were the first examples of underwater technology. So it is very difficult to find pieces in excellent conditions as of now, and needless to say, as always is the case in luxury, scarcity increases value. So that's a very interesting case. And then I would like to provide a third example, which is also another iconic model in our product line, which is still produced today. And we're talking about the Duograph Premier. In this case, the increase of the value, which is similar to the one of the Super Ocean, is given by the complication. The Duograph is indeed the Breitling watch that bears the chronograph complication with the split second one, a function which is more widely known with its French name, the rattrapant. It basically allows to measure different intervals of time elapsed just by pressing a pusher. And this complication, which is one of the most advanced ones, of course, in the history of watchmaking, made the watch being pretty expensive when it was sold from the 1940s onwards. So even in this case, the rarity of the timepiece itself made its value increase, coupled with, I would say, a renewed sensibility from the collector community about these specific functions and complications. I wanted to come with you with concrete examples to make you understand that, of course, buying a vintage watch can represent a good investment, but please allow me to stress another point. The best investment when buying a vintage watch or a lot of products from whatever brand is the joy that it brings you every single day when you look at it on your wrist. And this is something that cannot be measured, but it is definitely the most essential part of what we do.
Now, this opens up a quite interesting sphere, I would say. And I want to flip, Aurelia, with you on the approach Breitling does take towards circularity. And I want to like to extend the question in an environment of saying you have different departments that probably deal with it, right? but especially the joy of the matter. Is it reflected in your processes, how you approach as a company, circularity?
You know, what I love most about circularity being a sustainability professional is it really allows for the community and the personal touch point, because circularity is ultimately implemented at a very human level. And so, for example, myself and the entire Brightlane sustainability team is highly engaged with our colleagues across the company who are bringing the targets that we have to life. One of them is to be plastic waste free in just a few months' time. This is something that is requiring numerous efforts across all different departments. And you may not think of Brightlane as a plastic company, but as we know, plastic is pervasive in our lives. I think we're all deeply committed to this target, to this task, and to bringing it to life. And I have seen repeatedly across Brightlane the strong interest that we all hold in circularity, whether it's the amazing work being done by Gianfranco and the heritage team that gives us extraordinary pride in the history of Brightlane, whether it is the fact that we are recycling a numerous number of materials or reprocessing them and revalorizing them. This gives us a very good feeling that we're proceeding in a way that is responsible. And of course, being able to make our own contributions to circularity is something that is incredibly rewarding. So circularity is for me a key lever in actually community engagement. And I think that that is really an unsung benefit of circularity, is the fact that it can bring us on board to have the same target, to have the same objective, and to have these great feelings of shared accomplishment at the end as well.
May I extend a little bit or dig deeper, Aurelia, please? How can I imagine that, let's say, someone from supply chain in your journey towards plastic free, how are they kind of incentivized? And I, of course, don't mean their salary. I mean, is there a KPI that they personally track that you maybe also celebrate once you've achieved it? Maybe some details other companies might even, you know, copy from you, which would be great.
Absolutely. So if maybe you're asking, okay, what is the nature of this plastic actually that we're producing along the way? I mean, it could be protections for the fingers when you're assembling equipment. It's the numerous amount of trays that the components in our watch, keep in mind, if you have a mechanical watch, it's over 300 components that are in it typically, that are housing these as they make their way along the supply chain. So within each atelier, as we call them, there's different components that are handled within each of them. So those are something that are tracked, then really I think we can also say these are teams, individual teams, and we're able to see along the way, what is the progress that's been made. So we're also working on communications to be able to share those achievements in a very meaningful way locally. So those are some of the ways that we really bring those to life, in addition, of course, to our overall target that we're able to communicate on regularly and that we work to engage on also with regards to the broader topic of circularity and recycling and the whole system related to this in order to raise awareness among our employees.
I think this is quite impressive. I would not have thought that a watch brand manufacturer would go to such details, but it perfectly makes sense. I'd like to continue our discussion and journey here with Gianfranco, because Gianfranco, I've learned not only the topic of heritage that plays, of course, a huge role in storytelling for your own brand, but I've understood there's also almost like a new R strategy that Breitling is introducing, which is called Rewind. I may have this little side note. Can you explain a little bit more to our listeners what it is about and where it relates to circularity?
With pleasure. It is a project that actually brings us a lot of joy and a lot of pride, and what ideas that I'm more proud to have introduced 2.5 years ago in November 2024. So Rewind, of course, plays on the meaning of the word associated with winding a watch, or rewinding it in this case. That's why we chose this specific name. And it's a project that allows us to sell a very limited selection of vintage watches that are purchased from our department all over the world, then are restored and certified by our vintage after sales team, which is a very small but super effective team of watchmakers that are specialized in vintage watches. And then these watches are provided with an international warranty of 2 years, given by Breitling and valid everywhere in the world, and sold in a different place in the world. We chose as a strategy to have this special event staged not only in a different country, but actually in a different region every year, because we want to provide the highest visibility to the program, but also to the circularity that lies behind it. So the first edition was indeed held in Paris at a very specific trade show, which focuses on circularity and upcycling of products in luxury. And then second edition was held in Mexico City last October. And the third one, well, we cannot announce it yet, but after Europe and Americas, of course, we are moving to Asia. This is what I can say at the moment. The idea behind Rewind is actually double. On the one hand, we wanted to shed a light on pieces that are maybe less known from our collections, but that deserve the attention of the wider public, because as I always have the pleasure to say, the Heritage Department is maybe the most cultural one, together with the sustainability that we have in the company. So for us, even an operation like this, which could look like a commercial operation, is actually an opportunity to spread a cultural invisibility about our watches and products in general, and to keep doing storytelling, which is actually one of our main tasks. On the other hand, it is an opportunity to showcase the savoir-faire of our people. As I said, of watchmakers that are specialized into sourcing vintage parts for the watches and restoring them. And as a third opportunity, it allows us to raise the value of vintage watches, because, of course, in this case, the company is committed to bring these pieces back to life and to allow a wider knowledge of these products in particular, which, of course, reflects itself into a systematic increase of these pieces in the market.
To deep dive here as well a little bit. So where are these watches, these Rewind watches, if I understood it correctly, coming from? Not where they originate, because they originate, of course, from you, from the Atelier in the first place, but where are they coming from?
Well, we purchase watches wherever we have the opportunity to do so. So it might be a network of collectors and watch dealers that we are constantly in contact with. We may scout some pieces in auctions all over the world. And also, let's not forget it, we have owners of vintage watches that reach out to us. We have a very specific mailbox, which is clearly heritage@breitling.com, to which everyone who is in love with the brand and with its history can reach out to. And so among the hundreds of emails and requests that we receive every month, sometimes we have some interesting offers from people that want to sell their watches, and they thought about selling to the mother company. And so we happily buy back some of these watches. And then, as I said, we restore them and then certify them before reselling them.
Now, I imagine that probably the watches coming back, they're not all in perfect condition. So you're probably going to recondition them to some point. Can I imagine that you have a huge warehouse full of small little pieces and parts that you fix it up, or do you produce them on a historic technical drawing? Or how does that work?
Well, in most of the cases, we actually, as you said, have the opportunity to leverage on the stock of pieces that is still in the company. So, of course, we tend to purchase models that we are sure we are able to restore internally. From some cases of spare parts, we also request support of specialized suppliers that already work with our after-sales department and that can manufacture specific spare part when needed. But most of the time, we actually leverage on our internal stock.
Now, I'd like to link, if it's possible, and it's up to you to decide who's going to answer on that. But I'm genuinely intrigued, especially since I'm a business romantic myself, to your storytelling and the heritage that comes with your original brand story. But I would like to extend it, or I'm thinking myself, that the person that wore the watch, they are imposing their own stories on the pieces. And I wonder, are they somehow reflected in almost like the traceability, not of a gold piece, but of the watch itself? And if so, if there is such a linkage to it, you know, because you could say it's a used watch, but it's a Rewind, it's a heritage watch. Does that play a role in your sustainability narrative? Because, you know, how sexy is that?
Well, I can answer maybe the romantic part of it and then leave the sustainability one to Aurelia for obvious reasons. But yes, indeed, I always say that the watch every single watch carries usually at least three stories in itself. One is the story of the brand. I'm talking about vintage watches. One is the story of the brand, which means, of course, models that have been produced for some specific functions or that were destined to a specific type of public. We mentioned before the Navi Timer, for example, which was born as a watch for pilots. Then we have the story of the previous owner or owners, the stories that somehow and sometimes are literally engraved on the watch itself. Let's think about, for example, all the dedications that you get on the case back. And also that usually come with the watch when the watch arrives to us. So we have the opportunity to learn about, I don't know, the hairs of the owner, about how their dad or mom used the watch all over the world by traveling, or in which specific photographs of the family albums the watch is featured, and so on and so forth. And then there's the new story that we are giving to the watch with his new life. And this is the story that we are about to write with the new owner. So every time that we actually sell one of these vintage watches to their new owner, we provide them with a gift. The gift is the book we wrote in 2024 for the 100 years of Breitling, called 140 Years in 140 Stories. And the idea is always that by giving the collection of our best stories to every single new owner of a vintage watch, we invite them to write their own story, which would become a consequence of the stories that they will read with the book. So we are very romantic, as you can say. I mean, I'm Italian. What can I do about it? There's an inherent romanticism that always comes up. I hope I answered your question perfectly.
Thank you. It totally makes sense. I could deep dive for hours, but let's look at the sustainability metrics part or the story on that side.
It's hard to follow up on what Gianfranco just said. I just want to say that he knocked it out of the park. And I think really the core message for us is really being able to convey the message in a tangible manner that Breitling is a company that takes responsibility for its products for the long term. And the fact, for example, that we have watches that are well over 50 years that are repaired in-house using components, in many cases, that have always been in the possession of the company, for me just shows an absolutely extraordinary foresight, level of care, and respect for the products that have been created and for the resources, including the natural resources that have contributed to them. And for me, this story is just outrageously inspiring, especially in the world that we're living in today, where there may be instances of fast fashion, which is the complete opposite of this. And I just find it incredibly inspiring because it can also raise the question, you know, how do we care for other products in this way? What else do we put out into the world? And what would it look like if we knew that we needed to continue to care for it for 100, 140 years?
So let's, after the romantic part and sustainability part, there's also, of course, a business part that has to make it irresistible to you, Gianfranco. It may look obvious, but what's the business logic behind it? How does it work in commercial terms?
Well, I would say, of course, there is a business part which is taken into consideration because we are not a no-profit company. We usually have the purchase price of the watch, which we negotiate at a convenient price so that then we can consider the value and the cost of the restoration that we do on the watch, which allow me to stress another time, is always done with the most attentive and conservative approach. We avoid replacing pieces as much as possible. We prefer to recondition existing pieces when possible. We must of all avoid polishing, for example, the cases, because the beauty of a vintage watch lies in its patina and in the life that he had lived over the decades. And third, so as I said, we need to cover the cost of the restoration. And then, of course, we have a margin for the market that in the end sells the watch. Because the logic is that we, as headquarters, sell the stock of vintage watches to the market that is going to host the edition of Rewind in a specific year. And then it's the market selling them to the final customers. Of course, there is a certain level of profitability in the operation itself. But as I said before, the main aim of Rewind is actually to, once again, tell stories. So we have the opportunity to reinforce the storytelling behind our icons, the most significant models in the product range. Which of course reverberates to the current collection, because basically I would say around 90% of the current Breitling product offer is strongly inspired by products of the past. So by telling the story of the Super Ocean, of the Chronomat, or of the Navi Timer, and presenting a vintage timepiece, we also strengthen the message that the timepiece that we produce today is strongly inspired by that specific timepiece that we are now reselling through Rewind. Allow me to say, for example, that the Navi Timer has been for sale for over 70 years. I mean, it had been launched in 1952. It's one of the most long-lasting watches in the history of watchmaking. So by presenting, once again, a vintage timepiece, we have the opportunity to make the final collector aware also of the current production. And third, there is, as I said earlier, an opportunity to share to shed a light on collections that are not anymore produced. A very concrete case is, for example, the Sprint. So this is a watch that was launched in the early 1970s for the younger generations, basically, and is characterized by a very vibrant selection of colors for the dials. So this watch is currently not produced anymore, even though it inspired another collection of current production. But we found it so iconic that we decided to put it on the cover of the famous book that I was referring to earlier, the 140 Years in 140 Stories. And we usually sell one Sprint in every edition of Rewind so far, because people just love it. I mean, you get this watch with this vibrant orange dial, or electric blue, or bright green, and so on, and people are crazy with it. So every time that we bring one, they're like, yes, please, let us find another color next year. So there will be a Sprint also in the upcoming edition in summer 2026.
Wonderful. We need to go on. Maybe in half an hour, we know the specific location in Asia. One follow-up question. It's super refreshing when I listen to both of you and you lay out the meaningful level of your activities and the identity it brings to you and to your customers. In what respect is Rewind a business, or is it more serving the brand? Is it taking care of the heritage? Of course, it's all three of them. But is there a leading motivation? How do you balance that?
I guess it is very embedded in the brand identity. I always say, when I mention the activity of our department, I always say that we are the historians, but we don't look at history in a dusty way, which is, for me, fundamental. And it also is reflected on the average age of my team members. I mean, out of five people, three of them are under 35. And I would love to say that I'm under 35 myself, but I'm barely over 35, let's say. So what I mean is that we really look at history with a fresh and youthful approach. And most of all, that we do not consider the history of Breitling as a dusty topic. We are the custodian of the brand DNA. And the fact that we have, luckily, a brand whose contemporary production is so strongly inspired by the products and the figures that made Breitling great in the past, allows us basically to go from, as we said, a cultural approach to a business-oriented one. There is not only I'm in charge of, for example, dealing with museums, exhibitions, and other cultural opportunities, but I also work hand-in-hand with the product department to make sure that the new products that are launched do respect the identity of the brands and of their ancestors of the past. Then I work, for example, with sales to make sure that our trade marketing always embody vintage pictures or pictures of vintage watches in general, so that we show the continuities that goes to our product. So I would say heritage is in the company organization. My department sits within marketing, but is indeed embedded with basically all other departments, because we work a lot even with ICT, for example, because we're setting up databases of information about the history of the brand. So we really are basically everywhere, and this allows us, as I said, to transition smoothly from culture to business without sounding incoherent.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I have two final questions. The first one is to Aurelia. We talked a lot about the past, about awesome pieces, 50, 80, 100 years old. How does it translate into your circularity and sustainability discussions today? Because one might think that you have to consider that today you're shaping the circularity of the company and the pieces in 50, 100 years from now into the future. So does it translate like that?
I think that's absolutely the case. You know, this this perspective that's been with the company for 142 years now is something that is really still staying and defining the future as we move forward. And so the work of Gianfranco, the work of the heritage team, is something that needs to continue to inspire us today. And it's something that is really core to our work in sustainability. It's an incredible opportunity to work for a heritage brand like Breitling in the role of sustainability, because you get to be at a point of time to look back on an incredible history of 140 years, but also to look that far into the future. And from that perspective, it allows us to consider, with the sustainability values that we have, how are these being integrated into our products today? How will they be received by the owner or future owner of a product in, let's say, 2066? And what is the value of the work that we're doing today to integrate sustainability in those? How does it stand the test of time? And how does it contribute to the meaning as well? If I think of the products that we've been releasing in the last several years with the Origins label, having launched this in 2022 with traceable gold and traceable lab-grown diamonds, I wonder how they will be received in Breitling Rewind many, many years down the road. Perhaps this will be marketed as, you know, imagine this is the very first traceable watch that Breitling has put out, and imagine what will be the value of that watch in that time. And I think that's something that's really important for us to keep in mind, because as Gianfranco said, you know, being custodians of the brand and contributing to this custodianship of the brand is really key, and being able to reflect the values that we hold as a company, but we know that our broader stakeholder group knows as well. We're obviously regularly engaging on the topic of sustainability, our suppliers, our customers, the watch industry, media experts, the list goes on and on, to really be able to understand what are our shared values in sustainability and how do we bring those practically to life. So sustainability and heritage, they are natural companions on this mission. We have the chance to really inform each other's work in an extraordinary and really powerful way.
Fantastic. Gianfranco, my last question goes to you, and this is about the topic of our series, which is about irresistibility. What makes Rewind irresistible for Breitling?
Well, I think it offers the opportunity also for the brand and for the people that make the brand to reflect on their own history and to take inspiration from it. Whenever we present the watches, we always, for example, present them with vintage advertisements, scans of vintage catalogs. So basically, it becomes, once again, it's kind of an exhibition in the end. I mean, the fact that these pieces are indeed sold at the end of the event doesn't make it less cultural. Imagine, I don't know, a major auction house presenting a show before the sale takes place. It's more or less the same idea. It makes it irresistible because it gives the product people, the marketing people, the opportunity to see icons of their past and to get inspiration for what they're going to be doing in the future. And it makes it irresistible, I would say, also as a corporate dimension, because it shows how the brand pragmatically takes care of its past, not only by highlighting its icons in communication, but literally by restoring them and putting them back at the wrist of new customers by basically giving them a new life.
Fantastic. Karel, we talked about this whole series and especially the role of Breitling before, and this is a wonderful example, as we mentioned at the beginning, where value doesn't decrease, it increases over time. When is that the case?
That's an excellent question, and I think I got some answers out of the session today, because on multiple level. First of all, it is when you consider it on a systemic level. This is very key, it seems like. And it originates because sustainability is obviously here not seen as a departmental add on to anything. It's core to doing business because it is more like the people doing in the 18th, 19th century forest agriculture than accountability, right? Because it is connected to almost cathedral thinking and next generation. It's all systemically bound together. And to put it simple or in very basic words, and Gianfranco alluded to it, the value is happening when patina as a physical embodiment of its story. Because it's directly related to the material, but it's also a proof point, almost like a part of the traceability story that Aurelia was starting off the conversation. So I really have to put it together that it increases then, and I could be a little bit ironic, but I mean it was a very humoring way. It is when you do have a heritage department, that's what you need. When you do have that in a company, you could say, you know, then you will produce things that increase value over time. So to make it really bold, I think everyone should be thinking about having a heritage department, maybe even rather than a sustainability department.
I can think of a couple of brands that still would need to go a long way, even if they had a heritage department. I'm pretty sure many listeners are inspired. What are some steps to take towards being eligible to have this department and build the basis for long-lasting product value?
So again, now let's be a little bit technical of what I understood, and I very much resonate with that. It's again viewing it systemically. I think if you only departmentalize it, it's going to be very difficult, and we've seen that today. So it's a recurring theme we heard of, hey, you have to see it as a system, because only when you buy, sell new stuff, also have a little bit of the vintage of the story of your own story into it, embed the story of the product as it grows over time and so forth. So it's always interconnected. It seems like we heard stories from the departments, even on such a point of how can we become plastic free? It goes through every department, obviously, because we have it maybe in the shipping or logistics department, but we obviously have it also in the atelier where they have some finger covers so that they probably don't scratch the surface of a new watch and things like that. So this is what I, unfortunately, Patrick, I rarely hear, that companies are truly systemic. I got the sense today that Breitling is using that as one of their biggest assets on a cultural and procedural way.
Mm-hmm. And then as a follow-up question, what are the barriers you need to overcome to get to this systemic approach?
Well, now here it becomes much more difficult, I would say, right? I think, and this is probably easy for a company that produces timepieces, because it probably just takes time, and I'm literally talking about compounding effects, where you have the nature, the mathematical part about compounding effects are or is time. So you have to give it time. And this is probably something that is the barrier that people are too stressed, too much focused on today, and they don't value the compounding effect that your business could have if you treated certain metrics differently. If you kept parts for 80 years, I mean, go and find that, right? A company that produces stuff that has somewhere stocks that have been sitting there for 80 years idle, that probably doesn't happen because we're so focused on a fiscal year and things like that. So maybe it's just to have a little bit more time for contemplation.
Yeah. Ultimately, and this is my last question, what's, if I want to go down that road, what's the benefit towards business success?
So here again, what I understood from both sides, from Ria and Franco, is that you have to have a solid piece of communication. It needs to be systemic. But if you do that, then you can repeat yourself. You know, it's basically beating the same drum over and over in a certain way, but in a very positive way. So this is what I feel. So what I heard today, that there was no juxtaposing of things that don't match. It was very much intertwined, and this is probably, I assume, not only for the rewind and heritage models and vintage models. It probably goes as part of the DNA through and through. Honestly, this is something I think a lot of people can get aspiration. Of course, most companies don't run luxury businesses. But hey, it's always the question, where do we draw inspiration? And we all remember 20 years ago or 15 years ago when everyone was citing Apple and Steve Jobs, how great they are, you know. And here we find a company, a brand that exists since 140 years, and probably there are many more brands that have this heritage, but are maybe not capitalizing, literally capitalizing on the opportunity, their heritage department, their story, the threefold stories can deliver.
Well, please take that as an invitation, dear listeners. Thanks, Karel. Thanks, Aurelia. Thanks, Gianfranco, for sharing your experience.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Pleasure to be with you.
This marked our fifth episode in the series Irresistible Circular Business. In sponsoring partnership with Indeed Innovation, the global design and innovation firm pioneering the circular economy. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, sign up for the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. Do you want to learn more about how leading brands are turning returns into revenue? Then download the WeCommerce Playbook by Indeed Innovation. You will find the link to it in the show notes. In the next episode, we will hear from Airbus how they improve their cash flow by sharing resources internally. Let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.